This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our family fanboys.
You know, we have a sound editor that could have done that for us, right? God, what do we need? What do we need Todd for? You can just do all the sound effects for us.
Yeah, that was pretty good, wasn't it?
I guess.
Isn't it good?
I guess good is a word for it.
Isn't it good? Yeah. That fanfare that just brought us in. It just brought us in here to the show. indicates that it's time for another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen and children of all ages. Hopefully no children are listening at this time. I am Greg Phillips. The voice on the other end of the line here is Nick Duke. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and we are coming to you from the L-shaped studio in beautiful Hoholoon Plaza.
Serene.
Oh, yeah, beautiful and serene Hoholoon Plaza. Mm-hmm. It's freshly trimmed, freshly.
Why does the plaza have to be trimmed?
Well, it's, you know, a few weeks ago, I noticed when we pulled in that our groundskeeper, Curly Bill, had allowed it to grow into a landing strip there, and I thought, well, we want the studio lawn to be trimmed, so.
Now, I don't know. If Ric Flair were our groundskeeper, he would say, no, you gotta let it, let it grow a little bit natural.
So I chastised Curly Bill, and he fixed it. And now, and we're in beautiful and not ludicrous, but lovely Vancouver, British Columbia. Ludicrous! And you know, Nick, Vancouver is feeling particularly crisp this month, I would say. How have you found it to be thus far?
I love it. You know, I love the cold weather, being a fat man. So it's nice to be in my natural environment for once.
That's right. Not like our home of
no
hell, USA.
It was in the damn 70s this week in Columbus. Mm. The 70s in December.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, there are those out there that would celebrate this heresy. They'd be happy with a 70-degree Christmas.
No.
But there ain't no songs about a 70-degree Christmas. Bing Crosby wasn't out here singing about I'm dreaming of a green hot Christmas.
I'm dreaming of a swamp ass Christmas. Nobody sings about
that. Nobody sings about that. Nobody talks about walking in a actually moderately temperatured wonderland, you know?
No.
It's a winter wonderland. Anyway, we're not here to talk about the weather. Although we are old men talking about the weather.
Yeah.
And we know there's a lot of you old women sitting out there talking about old men.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, how long you been faithful?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, just listen to how this song ends.
Some would say forever. Some would not. Quite frankly, it's not for me to say.
Amen.
Mm-hmm.
Amen, that's right. All right. Well,
good Lord, what are we doing?
We are back in Wing It Month here at the studios. We are just winging it. Every week we're just giving you new content. We're not promoting it ahead of time because we don't know what we're going to do until the day of the show.
No, scheduling has gone out the window in the last couple of weeks. It's just sometimes we wake up, we're like, hey, let's do this, and then we do it.
That's, so what we decided to do this week is we're just taking something we've already done out of leisure, and we're going to turn it into our show this week.
Yes. Those of you who listen to our podcast regularly know that we each and every week we have our segment, the back half, reading and watching. And watching during this time of the year primarily consists of our CW, our beloved stories. And usually the way we do that is we run kind of a week behind to give everybody an opportunity to have watched the episodes so we can discuss them, you know, with spoilers, without, you know, without fear of upsetting people who may not have gotten around to them. This time out, we're going to take a little bit of a different approach.
Yes, we are indeed going to take a bit of a different approach. You see, we are going to just start the show here. We're going to have our front half of the show be our exclusive review. Mm-hmm. I don't really know why it's exclusive. It's just, I mean, it's our exclusive. This is the only place you'll find our review, by God. and it's of the first three parts of the CW's Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover event. Obviously, we cannot review the entire event because the last two parts of it, episodes 4 and 5 of this crossover,
don't air for another 5 weeks.
That's right. Don't start the airing on the nights of January 14th and 15th.
No, all on the 14th.
Oh, all on the 14th. My bad.
Yes.
So both episodes will air on the 14th. So,
I believe that's correct anyway.
And so that puts us back a little bit in that regard. But what we can do is we can offer our view of what has been the talk of the comic book world the last several days, which is Crisis on Infinite Earths. It's the biggest crossover event yet attempted on comic book television, to my knowledge, Nick, unless you can think of a more encompassing or bold one that's been done.
I cannot.
And so, you know, this is going to be a pretty involved discussion. It will involve spoilers. Warning everyone ahead of time, if you have not watched parts 1, 2, and 3 of the crossover, because I don't think we're necessarily going to tackle these episode by episode, but rather look at this in totality to this point.
Right.
And so if you haven't watched any of the parts, don't listen to this episode.
No.
Go and watch the episodes and then listen to our review. Or if you're somebody that doesn't care about spoilers and you're curious whether you should check this event out, you can listen to the review and make your opinion from that. So with that being said, Nick, anything else we should preface with before we get cracking here?
So, you know, we've as I said, we've been doing reading and watching, and we've been reviewing the CW seasons up to this point. Those of you who do listen to the show regularly will know that Greg is weeks behind on both on Black Lightning, on Supergirl, and on Batwoman, and yet he just decided to not bother with catching up. So we have had numerous gaps in the reviews of those episodes. We're not going to talk about those. We're just going to jump straight to Crisis because that's the perspective that Greg has on it.
Yes, and that's not entirely accurate, by the way, the way you described it, Nick. I have caught up completely on Arrow and the Flash. As far as Batwoman goes, I have not caught up on. I've only watched the first three episodes of that. The last one I watched was the Hush episode. So I am behind on that. Supergirl, I actually attempted this past Saturday. As you know, Nick, I had no reason to watch football this past Saturday. And so in my gloom and doom, I turned on the television and I said, well, what can I do? I know what I'll do. I'll catch up on CW stuff. I caught up on Flash, caught up on Arrow. I said, what am I going to do next? I'm going to catch up on Supergirl, only to pull up the CW app, the only place, by the way, that you can watch Supergirl right now, and outside of the CW, obviously, only to find they had the first episode of the season and then like the fifth episode of the season. And then 6 and 7 or whatever they're up to now, 8. So I said to myself, no, I'm not going to watch the first episode and then skip 3 episodes and watch the next one after that. No, I'm not going to do that. So the CW app prevented me from catching up on Supergirl. Black Lightning, I'm still a season and a half behind on. I knew I wasn't going to watch that many episodes. So that's why I decided to just dive in to the Crisis event itself. But I will say this, Nick, to their credit, I think this actually helps our review a little bit because you're caught up on everything and I'm not. And so it gives us different perspectives. But I have to say, from my perspective, I didn't have any problems following anything that was going on in this crossover event, even having not watched Black Lightning. I think the ones that I've missed have been the least essential to the crossover, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Batwoman and Black Lightning both, I would say, are completely inessential. Batwoman obviously is a much bigger part of the crossover than Black Lightning is, but her own individual show hasn't really dealt with any crisis buildup. I do think there are things in the season of Supergirl that you've missed, particularly as it relates to John Jones and kind of that cliffhanger they had coming out of last season's season finale, where they revealed that the Monitor had brought the Martian Manhunter's brother out of the Phantom Zone. And so there's been a lot of stuff with that, and you kind of get the reveal of what exactly the true nature of that was and what the purpose of that was. So there are things in there that I think would be beneficial to you, but Batwoman and Black Lightning, pretty much nothing.
And there's a scene early on in the crossover between Lena and Alex, mm-hmm. where they're talking about backstory of what mm-hmm. Lena has done this season. I know they're at odds, but I was able to piece it together, sort of. I still don't know the details of it, but I was able to piece it together through their conversation that, you know, basically Lena, you know, now that she knows the secret, she feels betrayed by everyone, no mm-hmm. longer trusts them, and has at some point attempted to use some sort of a weapon against them of some kind.
Kind of a weapon, kind of not. I mean,
she's not gone full heel yet, is what I'm getting at.
Right, right.
She's not full heel, but she's teetering that way. She's sort of like, mm-hmm. she's sort of like Seth Rollins last week versus mm-hmm. this week.
Yes.
Teetering on the edge of heeldom, but not quite there. And really the parallels to her journey to Lex's journey on Smallville are very similar, but that's another story for another time. We're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about this crossover event itself. So Crisis on Infinite Earths carries with it a massive burden, a massive weight, a massive expectation from the audience, and that is at least in part due to the magnificence of the comic book story, the sheer magnitude of it as well. The 1984-85 comic book series Crisis on Infinite Earths by Marv Wolfman and George Perez. Most of our listeners will know about that. It's very obvious that it's happened. One of the most important stories in DC's history. I would say it's in the very small handful of the most important DC stories. And what that story did was take the existing multiverse, an infinite amount of Earths, if you will, and essentially mash them all together into one surviving new Earth that formed the basis of the DC universe for decades to follow. We don't know exactly if that's going to be what this event does, but it seems to be heading that way. The premise of this story is that the you see, in the beginning, there was the Monitor and the Anti-Monitor. And the Anti-Monitor opposed the Monitor. Now, the Anti-Monitor is trying to overwhelm the positive matter multiverse with the antimatter universe and basically make that the only one. So he's trying to destroy all the existing universes with his antimatter wave. And the Monitor.
And now everyone's asleep and we can play GM mode. Good job, Greg.
I know. This was exactly what I planned on, Nick. This is actually how we begin our hard traveling hiatus. We'll then be playing GM mode for the
next. Don't be telling tales at a school just yet.
The Monitor has been going around, as we've seen him throughout the Arrowverse for the last, about a year now since the last crossover?
So, yeah, he popped up, I think, during the build-up to Elseworlds, right? And then was a major part of Elseworlds, which was last year, obviously, last year's crossover, mm-hmm. where we saw him, we saw the Psycho Pirate, we saw the Book of Destiny, we saw the debut of Batwoman, we just got all kinds of good stuff, and then you know, in Elseworlds, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen this year-old crossover, the Monitor revealed to Oliver that Barry Allen and Kara Danvers were both going to perish in the Elseworlds event. And Oliver refused to let that happen and asked the Monitor basically what he could do to avoid that outcome. And he said something about the cosmos demanding balance. And so Oliver, it was heavily implied at that point, offered himself up instead of Barry and Kara, offered to die in their stead. And so we've all kind of been building towards this crisis for many years now, not just with the debut of the Monitor, but, you know, going back to the very first episode of The Flash,
mm-hmm.
That had the headline in the future in the, I don't even know what they call that room, the Gideon room,
mm-hmm.
in Star Labs. where it said Flash missing, vanishes in crisis. And then we knew all along that we were building to the disappearance of the Flash in a crisis. And then since last year, we've known we were essentially building to the death of Oliver Queen in a crisis. So we've kind of been both looking forward to this and dreading it for a long, long time now.
And also, and since the end of last season, we knew that the timeline of the crisis, which was originally several years in the future from what we are now, had been accelerated, and that we would be seeing it as the next big crossover event. So,
right, because they announced that at the end of Elseworlds, yep. it popped up the Crisis on Infinite Earths logo. But you mentioned, you know, the excitement for this being based on the quality of the story and the importance of the story, which obviously that plays a role as well. But I think part of the excitement for this is also, again, we've been building to this literally for years. The CW verse, Mark Guggenheim and Greg Berlanti and all those guys, they kind of took the opposite approach of the DC extended universe, where instead of trying to be in a hurry and get to a massive story right off the jump, they really took their time in building to this. And so it's a combination of things, both the iconic nature of the story, and also this feels earned for these versions of the characters. It doesn't feel like too much too soon.
Absolutely. And one of the many benefits of this approach is that they don't have to introduce and make you care about characters over the course of these hours of these episodes. This story largely works because we already know and care about these characters. Granted, we've only known Kate Kane for a short amount of time, but we've already had some time to get to know and love her character. The same for Black Lightning. And even more so for the big three of Barry and Oliver and Kara, who we've gotten to know for many, many years. Oliver Queen and his supporting cast for 8 years now. And then on top of that, you know, even the legends, characters like Sarah and Mick Rory and Roy Palmer, people like this, that we already have an attachment to virtually everyone in here. Even the new characters, Harbinger and Pariah, sort of new characters, are actually existing characters just sort of transformed into these new versions. And so really all you're left to introduce the audience to as far as new characters are the Monitor, the Anti-Monitor, and the sort of cameo appearances, the alternate versions of heroes and villains that we may see along the way. And, you know, before we get into all that, Nick, one of the things you mentioned sparked something in my mind. We haven't actually seen the Psycho Pirate yet in this crossover.
Yeah, I'm not sure that he's really going to play a role. The role of the Psycho Pirate in the original Crisis, they've kind of, not to jump too far ahead, but his role, the things he was used for in the original story are kind of already over and done with. Like, it'd be kind of weird now to bring him in after these first 3 hours. But I'll be honest, I haven't really missed him. I don't think most of us, and I say most of us, we're looking for a literal adaptation of Crisis.
Now wait just a minute. We need to make it clear this is not an adaptation or an adaptation of Crisis on Infinite Earths. This is merely a version of Crisis on Infinite Earths. It's an interpretation, a different interpretation of it than a true adaptation, right, Nick?
That is correct. And I know there are many of us, or some of us, who have spent years reading and rereading and rereading and rereading this one story over and over again, who wanted it to be literally just the comic put on the screen, but that's not what we're getting. So we have to understand that before we can really discuss it first and foremost.
Yes, although I do understand that there is talk next year of doing a motion comic version of Crisis on Infinite Earths on the CW in primetime on television. So,
or perhaps a comic book theater version that of course would be started and never completed.
Yes, absolutely, with a cast of ones. In any event, the crisis is a, you mentioned that aspect, it's been built to for many, many years on these shows. And I think the other third aspect of it that has made it so anticipated is that it's bold and risky. We talked about this during one of our Giant Size podcasts about the MCU and how bold and risky it was to do, and how it had kind of never been done before on television. And I think never been done before in film. This is that for television, where we've got independently five and really six, if you throw in Black Lightning, independent shows that have their own storylines, their own characters, their own sort of worlds within worlds across, what, three, four different Earths between all these shows? And we're seeing them all cross over and work together and sort of collide their independent natures into this cohesive narrative, showing that you don't necessarily have to, out of the gates, you know, through all these allusions to other shows, you can still tie in. This is how crossovers kind of used to be done back in the day, is if you wanted to do a crossover between the $6 million man and the Bionic Woman or whatever, you could just have them meet each other and they're in the same world. Hey, guess what? We're in the same world. And you kind of get that here, although through the lens of the multiverse. So it's kind of cool to see that Black Lightning's been doing its own thing for two, three seasons now. But when he pops into Crisis, he didn't feel out of place. It felt like, okay, yeah, this makes sense. He's a superhero. They're superheroes. They're working together. And so I think people were excited to see how this is going to be played out in practicality, because no one's ever really tried it before. And so for me, anyway, it's been cool to see just how they've weaved these characters and these storylines together into a way that makes sense, that works, and that is super fun and not bogged down in trying to explain who everybody is and what their backstory is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much assuming that you've bought in at this point. Like, it's assuming that you've at least, maybe not, you know, watched every single episode up to this point, but you at least have a working knowledge of not just who these characters are, but that you kind of would, you know how the DC universe in general, you know, works a little bit. That you're familiar with various DC properties over the years, as we will discuss. I mean, there are so many homages and so many nods and so many pulls from so many different DC properties, some beloved, some reviled. It all counts in this event.
Yes. So with all that being said, the crossover sort of hits on so many different aspects. It's hard to even talk about where to begin without going through a, you know, scene by scene summary. But, you know, what have been some of the high points so far, Nick, for you in this crossover? Well, actually, before we get that, we will do just sort of an overview of what we've had to this point. So the antimatter waves are coming across, destroying worlds. We've lost Supergirl's Earth. Earth 38 is wiped out very early on.
Well, even earlier in the season, we lost Earth 2 in the first episode of Arrow's new season.
Yes, indeed. We lost Earth 2. We've lost Earth 38. We get cameo appearances throughout Crisis of these alternate versions of heroes, whether it be the Birds of Prey version of the Huntress, which was cool, whether it be the 1966 Robin, Burt Ward, out there walking what we assume is Ace the Bat-Hound. What was his line, Nick? Do you remember?
Holy crimson skies of death.
Beautiful. And of course, Alexander Knox, who appears to have been eating at the same deli as Robin. And I want to join them. I want to join them. Listen, I'm fat too. I get it. Ain't nothing wrong with that. And they all get wiped out. All their worlds get wiped out. The Titans Earth is shown, of course.
Yeah. Of DC Universe's Titans.
Yeah. Which nobody really saw coming. And along the way, we meet these characters again. We lose these characters again to the antimatter wave. And it's basically unstoppable. The heroes band together to try and find a way to stop this antimatter wave, but it just keeps coming until there's only one Earth left, and it's Earth 1, the Arrow Earth, if you will, for Arrow, the Flash, and Legends of Tomorrow. And it's you know, the heroes do their best to stop it. There are sacrifices made, and we actually meet and lose in a very emotional moment the Flash of 1990. And he dies the classic Crisis on Infinite Earths Flash death. We meet and lose the Christopher Reeve Superman, played by Brandon Routh, brilliantly, I might add. And of course, the Smallville Earth, Lois and Clark on there. We lose all these people and all these Earths. And when the crossover concludes, at least at chapter 3 of the crossover concludes, Earth 1 gets wiped out. The Anti-Monitor has won. He defeats the Monitor. Even though they shut down his antimatter wave, it doesn't matter. The Anti-Monitor takes out the last of the heroes, envelops the universe, and all that is left are the 7 Paragons, which are characters that
well,
are,
6 Paragons plus 1.
Plus 1, yeah. Yeah, it turns out to be 6 instead of 7 due to a swerve at the hands of Lex Luthor, who wipes out the beloved Brandon Routh Superman, replaces him, and we're left with the Paragons. Sarah Lance, Barry Allen, Hank Henshaw, sorry, John Jones, not Hank Henshaw. who else?
Ryan Choi.
Ryan Choi.
The new Ryan Choi, yeah.
Supergirl, Kara Danvers.
Mm-hmm. And Batwoman.
And Batwoman. And these are characters that have a specific purpose to play in the crisis that are needed to save the multiverse or what's left of it at the hands of the Anti-Monitor. And that's pretty much takes us up from a plot standpoint where we're at. We've had some things happen along the way, obviously, that we'll get into over the course of this. The death and sort of resurrection of Oliver Queen, shockingly, in the first episode with his death. We've had Barry Allen try to sacrifice himself, but ended up seeing the Barry Allen of 1990 sacrifice himself. We have seen a Batman who is broken and warped, a warped, frustrated old man, Mr. Potter version of Batman. And we've seen, Lois and Clark, as I mentioned, in Smallville. And we've seen a super baby get born. We've seen little Jonathan Kent get sent off in a rocket ship by his parents as their world is dying. We've seen that before using some of the original dialogue from Superman the movie. How cool is that? But with all that being said, that sort of sets the plate for where we're at from a plot standpoint. But let's just talk about the moments, because ultimately, Nick, I think what we're talking about the next day are the moments from these episodes. We kind of know, the Anti-Monitor, the Monitor, all that stuff is fine. It's great. But it's about the moments, the emotional beats. So let's talk about some of the high points so far. I know we've got a lot to hit here, but what have been some of the high points for you so far on this crossover event?
Well, I think first and foremost, the cameos, like you referenced, Alexander Knox, Robert Wool's character from the 1989 Batman film, Burt Ward popping up for a moment, the Huntress from the Birds of Prey show popping up, and then other appearances that are a little bit more than a cameo. Even as someone who wasn't a Smallville fan, getting to see Tom Welling back on the CW playing a version of Clark Kent was pretty cool. And then, of course, the big one for me was getting to see Kevin Conroy in live action, putting the Batman voice to use as a future, older, more grizzled version of Bruce Wayne that actually winds up playing a pretty major role in the second episode. So cool stuff like that, man. Just little nods and little cool ways of pulling in DC's past film history.
Yeah, I mean, let's get into some of these cameos here. So the first one I want to hit is Kevin Conroy, who obviously has been the voice of Batman since 1992, which he revealed actually on the Crisis Aftermath show was the first animated role he ever auditioned for. And it ended up being his most iconic role in live action or animation. He sort of, I think, Nick, for many of us, defined Batman for our generation, right? And whether it be in video games, cartoons, etc. But he's never had a chance to play him in live action. And this was a rare opportunity, maybe the only opportunity we'll ever get to see Kevin Conroy voice Bruce Wayne and see him physically doing it during and being able to act out during a show or a movie. And in this case, Nick, I was blown away, man. I thought he did a great job. I've only seen him in live action when I was a kid, and he was on a show called Tour of Duty that I watched when I was young, but I don't remember him specifically on there. I just remember vague images of the show because it was, the late 80s. But this was the first time that he's really had an opportunity like this that I'm aware of in some time. And I was really impressed. I thought he did a great job of playing this withered, hopeless version of Batman, of Bruce Wayne, who's been broken physically and seemingly psychologically by the world. He's just he's become a killer. It's almost, Nick, at first I thought of it as the Dark Knight Returns Batman, especially due to the nature of his fight with Superman. And then I started to think about it, and I was like, it's almost like what you could have seen the Zack Snyder Batman becoming had mm-hmm. they not done the last act of Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree.
And so I was really impressed by Kevin Conroy here, his interactions with Kate Kane. And what did you make of his, when you finally got to see it, did it live up to your expectations, or were you disappointed that he played a more villainous version of Bruce Wayne?
No, I didn't have a problem with it, because, I mean, typically when you hear older, grizzled Bruce Wayne, I mean, let's be honest, the Dark Knight Returns Bruce Wayne that we all glorify is pretty much a killer. Like, he's, you know, there's no issue, you know, the moral code has become a bit grayer. And so this kind of feels like a natural extension of that. And it serves the story, because it's needed to basically move Kate along in her journey, because in this version of Crisis, Bruce isn't the point. Kate is, right, as it relates to that scene. We're probably not going to get a recurring version of Bruce Wayne in the Arrowverse anytime soon. I still think we will get there eventually. I just don't think we're going to get there anytime soon. So I didn't have a problem with it.
I agree. I liked it too. I thought it was a really nice twist, especially since we all thought we knew what he was doing. We all thought we knew he was playing the Kingdom Come version of Batman. And so it was a nice twist that he wasn't, that it wasn't what we all expected. So I really appreciated that and thought the emotion was there. And like you said, it gave agency to Batwoman, who is a character that frankly needs agency in this crossover to feel like she belongs. Because it's easy to get overpowered when you're surrounded by characters that have been around a lot longer than you, that fans have more of an attachment to. So I thought that was very appropriate and needed. Now the other one, the one that was very emotional for me, probably the most emotional moment for me so far in the crossover, because of my attachment to the original show, was Smallville. Seeing Tom Welling and Erica Durance reprise their roles as Clark Kent and Lois Lane, respectively, of course. The interaction there, we see Lex interacting with Superman, the Lex of John Cryer, and Tom Welling, man, I got to be honest, Nick, it's the minute I almost started feeling like the emotions hit me as soon as I saw him in action, like with the classic flannel shirt that he wore on the show, chopping the wood. He just looks like Superman. He looks like Clark would have aged naturally, you know, like the natural evolution of teenage Clark into an adult. He's jacked to all get out. He has a commanding presence. And I love the fact that they play into that, by the way, to the sort of the criticism of Tyler Hoechlin, who's done a great job, by the way, of how, you know, that this every Superman they encounter just towers over him, basically. And in this case, Welling just, he so effortlessly got back into the role. It surprised me, like, because he could have easily half-assed this appearance, but it's obvious that it meant something to him, that it was a chance to sort of give a farewell to this character after all these years. And his interaction with Lex was wonderful, just how confident he was the whole time. And it was so Superman, because he's not cocky. He's not cocky. He's confident. and that was, there is a difference there, despite our old pals' assertions. But there was a difference in the way he carries himself. Superman carries himself with a certain confidence and swagger, and that's exactly what Welling had in that scene, where he doesn't have any fear of Lex for a moment, even though Lex has this ominous book in his hands that seemingly can do anything. The moment where he grabs the kryptonite and chunks it out in the field is so perfect. Probably my favorite moment. And then when we finally, he punches out Lex, and then finally Lois comes out, Erica Durance's character, and instantly their chemistry was back as she's ragging him for always, there was a constant joke on Smallville that he could never make her laugh. He could never say anything funny. Every one of his jokes was corny. And he finally makes her laugh by just telling her the truth of what just happened. And so from her calling him Smallville to just everything was pitch perfect on that. And they literally walk hand in hand off into the sunset. Beautiful moment. I know I've read online some people complaining that why would he give up his powers? Especially if Lex is still the president. That is a minor detail. Also, we don't know what Lex became after the show ended. But at the end of the day, that makes sense for this character to me. He always wanted to be a normal guy. He always wanted to fit in. He always wanted to have a family. It makes sense to me that eventually he would have done his deed. He would have lived up to his responsibilities, and then he would have retired and lived a life with Lois in isolation. And that's exactly what he did. So I loved it personally. And I know the other aspect, we talked about this offline, it would have been just that little much better if we had Michael Rosenbaum there as Lex.
Yeah, it would have been, I don't know if it would have been a little bit better. I'm not even a huge Smallville fan, but I think it would have been a lot better. Like, and it was already great. And that's no knock on John Cryer. It's just, think how much more emotional that could have been. Yeah. You know, that could have been ratcheted up. I mean, you could have even done like, because the version of the scene we get is that the idea is that Lex is hopping from Earth to Earth killing Superman. What if you did a version of it where Lex was hopping from Earth to Earth, giving that Lex's the ability to kill Superman? And you could even spin it as like, what if he goes to that Earth and gives Rosenbaum the ability to kill Superman and Rosenbaum doesn't do it?
Yep.
And like illustrates that they've, you know, become friends again or whatever.
Oh yeah. They absolutely. And it makes me wish that he had done it. I understand why he didn't do it based on his side of the story. I still wish he had done it though, because it would have added a little bit more to it. The other minor complaint I would have is I wanted a little bit more of him, quite honestly. I could have used more of Erica as Lois, because I think she is the best Lois. She and Terry Hatcher are kind of neck and neck as the best Loises. But that being said, I know there's only limited real estate in this crossover, and so I thought they really, as a good friend of ours would say, Nick, they maximized their minutes.
They did indeed.
So any other cameos you wanted to hit up? I know we got a cameo from an unexpected cameo from Lucifer.
The character who we know nothing about. We don't watch the show. We've never watched the show. We don't know anything about the comic based on. And yet the scene was awesome.
Yeah. Lucifer Morningstar from the Fox show that is now a Netflix show, Lucifer. And as Nick just mentioned, neither of us has ever watched this show or ever really had interest in it. But I got to say, Nick, after that scene, I'm now interested in watching the show because the guy was very charismatic.
Yeah, he was. And the scene was great. His interplay with pretty much everybody, particularly John Constantine, was awesome. So, pretty much any time this show, this event has reached out into other corners of the DC universe that aren't necessarily exclusively CW material, it's pretty much knocked it out of the park.
Yes, and let's talk about how they tie in some of these shows beyond just the cameos, because you know your main Earth, so to speak, Earth One, you're going to have your Flash, Arrow, Legends, stands to reason.
Batwoman, and Batwoman as well.
Batwoman, is she on Earth One or is she on Earth 38?
I'm pretty sure she's on Earth One.
So, and then you've got, of course, Earth 38 with Supergirl, but she's crossed over a bunch. So, these are your main players. They eventually bring in an alternate version of Mick Rory, actually. They go and they retrieve the Wave Rider from an alternate universe where the Wave Rider, instead of having the voice of Gideon, has the voice of Leonard Snart, Captain Cold. Which is a beautiful return for that character. We've always missed him on all these shows. And a different version of Mick Rory, who, for all intents and purposes, is the exact same as our Mick Rory, really.
Yes.
And he does get a chance to – we get some great scenes with Mick and baby Jonathan as he is somewhat inappropriately reading the baby his romance novel, which adds – one of the cool things, Nick – all these shows we've talked about in the past on this show, all of these CW shows have their own identity. Arrow has always been the grounded show. Flash is the more superhero show, more sci-fi kind of show. Supergirl is traditional Superman show, basically. And now Batwoman is street level. And Legends has always been the comedy show, at least since season two. And they really did a great job of adding levity to things, whether it was adding Ray Palmer in with his natural comedy. Mick with the baby was great. The voice of Leonard Snart coming in. It really added some needed levity to these hours because it's a pretty dour situation facing the heroes. Not a lot of time for jokes and humor, but when they are there, they really land.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are facing, you know, the biggest, the most dire, like you said, circumstances, the biggest set of consequences they've ever had to deal with. I mean, the literal loss of all life. But it's still the CW shows, and they still have a certain tone. And even Arrow, which we, you know, you and I both describe as the grounded show and the darker of the shows, still has had humor as a major component of it throughout its existence. So it would be, it would feel inauthentic to try and exclude that. And so the way they worked it out has been pretty good this far.
And actually, well, I forgot to mention this. I think it was last night's episode three. One of my favorite lines of the entire thing so far is when Cisco first hears the name of the of names of the monitor and the anti-monitor.
Or the, yes.
He's like, anti-monitor, can we workshop that or is that in stone?
Yes.
That was really good. So I've enjoyed the humor here. And then the other one that probably the hardest one to pull in going into this crossover, I thought was going to be Black Lightning, because of all the shows, it has been the most separate. It has completely done its own thing on its own earth.
Yep.
With certainly nods to the comics. They've made it clear that Jefferson Pierce is a big Superman fan, but it comes from the comic books in his universe. So him showing up and seeing two Supermen and be like, oh my God, the Superman thing is real? Was awesome. But the way they brought him in was so wonderful. And I got to say, Nick, we'll get to this at the end of this recap here, but one of my MVPs of this crossover so far has been Cress Williams as Black Lightning in just one appearance, one episode. He was tremendous because they brought him in, and you got to understand, folks, they brought this character in, and he just lost everything. Not like Kara, who lost a lot of people, but people she wasn't necessarily close to. He just lost his wife, both of his children, his entire planet, gone. No more Freeland. And the way he portrayed that with so much pain when he first hears about it, why wasn't it me? Why didn't you kill me instead? I would take their place. That it was so powerful and so good. His acting was so great and subdued. He didn't go over the top with it. He didn't, you know, he wasn't on his knees wailing and stuff like that. He played it the way that that character would play it. And then to see the sort of the pain in his eyes, even after he helps the heroes stop the antimatter wave, and he knows that things are never going to get better, things are never going to improve, and yet he mans up. And I thought it was tremendous, Nick. I don't know about you. I thought Cress Williams did an incredible job of making an impact despite being a late entry into this crossover.
Yeah, and pretty much only going to be in there for the one little 15-minute segment, it seems. So, but yeah, good job. Good job for him holding his own with the others.
And as far as other kind of high points so far, the sacrifice of the Flash, 1990. First of all, it mirrors the Crisis on Infinite Earths book with the cosmic, well, I guess it wasn't a cosmic treadmill, but sort of, yeah, a giant treadmill that is powering this antimatter wave, and the Flash runs so fast that he dissolves, essentially, ceases to be. And what put that scene over the top, Nick, I think you would agree, is the flashback right when the Flash is about to die, when John Wesley's ship is about to perish before our very eyes, and he has that flashback to the 1990 show, and they show that scene with he and Tina, his girlfriend, on the show, and it's this beautiful little tender moment, and when it flashes back, it makes the death all that more impactful.
Yeah, I would completely agree. even though I never watched the show, I've never seen this scene in question, but it adds a little bit of context to what his journey has been and kind of adds, you know, that little bit of that little bit of added tragedy, because now we're getting a sense of who this character is rather than simply who he is as it relates to what he means to Barry. So he takes on his own independence, and that makes the sacrifice feel that much greater.
One of my coworkers pointed out that he was very emotional about that scene because he watched the show when he was a kid, as I did, and loved it. And he said that it's so rare for a show that gets taken off the air early to ever get a chance to have a true finale. And he said for him, it felt like that was really the finale for that show, a chance to really wrap things up, in a chance they never got back in 1990. And it's true. Very rarely does a show get that opportunity. So that was really cool. And then the other aspect, talking about the adding that element of tragedy to his character, in some ways, Nick, it reminds me of what Geoff Johns did in Infinite Crisis with the Superman of Earth 2 and the Lois of Earth 2. Because we had no reason to be attached to those. I mean, at that time, I don't think I'd even read the original Crisis. And so I knew of them just through reading, you know, who's who in the DC universe and, you know, recaps of what happened in Crisis and all that stuff. But I didn't have any attachment to them. And over the course of that story, it actually made me care so much about the Earth 2 Superman that when he finally dies at the end of that story, it hurts, you know? And this is a character that you have no attachment to going in. And they show so I thought that was a really good step in the right direction. Now, the switcheroo done by Lex Luthor at the end is another homage to the comics. They actually end up reversing the Supergirl and Superman dynamic from the Crisis book, where instead of Supergirl dying in the arms of Superman, the Superman played by Brandon Routh dies in the arms of Supergirl. He actually fades out into an antimatter wave and is replaced by the ultimate trickster, Lex Luthor. And so that's that set us up for our status quo. What do we do now, as he puts it? So I thought that was a really clever nod as well. What are some of the other Easter eggs that you've appreciated in here, whether it's a newspaper clipping or something on a wall somewhere or a line of dialogue? What have been some of your favorite Easter eggs in this crossover to this point?
Oh, God, I don't even know. I think we've covered so many to this point. But one thing I didn't even notice till I watched the Crisis Aftermath show, the kind of Talking Dead esque reaction show hosted by Kevin Smith, is that early in the crossover, as Argo City is being destroyed, Superman and Lois think they have to send baby Jonathan off in a rocket, kind of mirroring what, you know, his own parents did. And the dialogue from that scene is actually lifted directly from Marlon Brando in 1978 Superman the movie. So that was something Mark Guggenheim pointed out, that they just literally stole the dialogue from that scene, which I thought was pretty cool.
Very. And actually in episode 2, they end up using the score from the classic John Williams score with the Brandon Routh Superman, which is cool. And, you know, I thought the one of the things, they can't use the Joker apparently in the Arrowverse right now. But what they did is they took advantage of every opportunity to reference him. So right. The newspaper at the very beginning that Alexander Knox is holding, Batman apprehends, I think it says Batman apprehends Joker, which is a little odd because Joker died at the end of the first movie, come to think of it, but maybe I'm misremembering that line from the newspaper. But regardless, later on, when Brandon Routh is talking about what happened to all of his coworkers, Lois, Perry, Jimmy, they're all dead because, as we find out, the Joker launched a practical joke, as he called it, a gas attack that ended up driving everyone mad and killing them. So I thought that was a really cool nod to the comics as well, nod to our knowledge of the Joker, and how it also kind of, you know, homages the fact that Superman doesn't really know how to deal with a threat like the Joker. He just can't fathom it. So that's cool. And other than that, just a lot of great moments throughout the crossover. Tom Cavanaugh as Pariah is great. Lila's doing a good job here. Finally got to see Diggle pop up. And probably one of the most surprising – what were you going to say, Nick? Sorry.
Nothing. I was just agreeing.
Yep. One of the most surprising moments so far came at the end of the first episode when Oliver Queen died. His sacrifice came far earlier than any of us thought, including the monitor. And then we saw in episode two, they were trying to bring him back to life via a Lazarus pit. Of course, that has dire consequences. And then episode three was about the quest to regain his soul once he's been revived from purgatory. But things don't go exactly as the heroes planned it, because right when they retrieve his soul and they get him back and they're ready to go back to the Wave Rider with him, Jim Corrigan appears, a character that was seen in the Constantine TV show, but who we haven't seen in the Arrowverse. And he briefly explains that he's the Spectre. And by the end of this scene, it certainly appears, Nick, that Oliver Queen is now the Spectre.
Yeah, that is the implication we get. And that seems to be a really cool role for him going forward. And it also opens the door for, despite his death, him to continue to have a presence periodically in the CW verse, which I think is best for all parties involved.
Absolutely. We need some Oliver Queen in our lives, and particularly Stephen Amell's version of Oliver Queen. So yeah, the Spectre's out there now. Interested to see. I'm assuming he's going to be the one that finally takes down the Anti-Monitor, and we'll just have to see what we've got coming on the last two episodes. But Nick, what do you want to see out of these last two episodes of Crisis? What are some things that you would like to see pop up along the way? I know I've got one thing in particular that I want to see.
I want to see John Diggle with a Green Lantern ring.
Yep.
Although John Diggle is dead right now, so they got to figure out a way to pull that off.
What we're saying is we want an alive John Diggle to then get a Green Lantern ring.
Maybe when they piece the Earths back together at the end, you could show that as being a part of his character, whatever. That would be cool. But other than that, I really don't know. I know that I want the One Earth thing. I think that, at least for the time being going forward, that makes the most sense. I want to see Supergirl and The Flash and Batwoman all inhabiting the same Earth. I mean, the only reason Supergirl's off on her own Earth anyway is because of the original, you know, the original broadcast arrangement for that show was that it was on CBS the first season. And now that it's a CW show, it kind of feels weird to have it off on its own little island. Black Lightning, I think you can bring Black Lightning onto Earth 1 and still have it mostly standalone.
I agree.
I don't really think just because it's on Earth 1 that it necessarily has to become, you know, shift in tone or its approach to storytelling. So I just think having everybody on one Earth with one continuity would be really cool.
I agree. I don't necessarily know that it's going to happen that way, but I think I hope it does. I think it should. I think it makes the most sense of these shows, particularly the Arrowverse shows. Because, you know, obviously I'm not expecting them to ultimately say that, well, Titans is also on this Earth. You know, maybe they will. But I think Black Lightning, there's no reason why Black Lightning has to be on a separate Earth, in my opinion. There's no reason why Batwoman or Supergirl, any of them, have to be on separate Earths. Combine them all together, smush them together, and whether you do it like they did in the comics, where nobody remembers what happened before, and that it's just like everything has always been this way, or whether they want to play with the fact that Supergirl just lost another planet in addition to her home planet. I think there's compelling stories to tell in either direction that you go. Like maybe they can bring, you know, some of the people come back, but many of them don't. Something like that. There have to be stakes to the crossover. I want to see that. The Diggle thing is the big one that I want to see. As far as fan service goes, they've given me everything I've wanted from this already. So if they give me Diggle just sliding on that green ring, that's all I'll need. I don't even need to see a construct or a guardian. Although if they have any guardians, I'd take those too. So that's pretty much what I want to see from this. And of course, a satisfactory ending to all the major characters and their interactions with one another. I do expect some status quo changes coming forward. So we'll have to see how that goes. Well, that being said, anything you want to add about this? Oh, we should probably talk about whether we've liked it or not. Yes, we've liked it a lot.
Yes.
It's been quite good. Quite good. So we hope you're enjoying it as much as we are. Let us know your thoughts on it. Tweet us at gphillips8652 or at nickduke87. Let us know your thoughts on Crisis on Infinite Earths, and what you're looking to see from these last two episodes. Any theories, by the way, about what's going to be happening moving forward, how are they going to overcome the Anti-Monitor? How are they going to bring back all these other Earths? Is it going to be, you know, the Book of Destiny that does it? What the hell is Lex Luthor doing? What's he got up his sleeve? Just let us know some of your theories. That could be fun to talk about on Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. So head over there once we've shared this episode, assuming I remember to do that. With that being said, we're going to take a little break-a-rooney here, and when we come back, we will have our weekly look at the news and notes segment called The Rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wingbar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the longest running
weekly
episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. Not the strongest work there, but
no.
We are back, and we are glad that you are still around. We're glad that you're still with us, both in the sense that you're still alive, and in the sense that you're still listening to this show. We hope you continue, because we're about to present you with the biggest news and notes in the world of comic books, a segment known wide and far as The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown, where we talk some comics.
My gosh, Nick, are you ready to talk about some of the big news items in the world of comics?
I don't see why not.
There's no good reason not to. So let's do it. Let's talk about the fact that Marvel Television is no more.
Man, this was something that Bleeding Cool reported was a rumor a couple months back, and you know, we kind of took it with a grain of salt, but looks like their sources were accurate on this one. And you can kind of see the writing on the wall, I think, the last few weeks, as we've seen, you know, the Ghost Rider show got shuttered before it ever got off the ground over at Hulu. As you'll reveal here when you read the story, there's been some issues with creative teams on those animated series that were announced for Hulu. And yeah, so this is something that seems like it was coming. Jeff Loeb departing. I don't know.
Yeah, so Marvel Entertainment's dedicated television studio, Marvel Television, is being absorbed into the Marvel Studios division. A number of positions will be eliminated, according to rumors, with the remaining others shifted over to Marvel Studios, which will act as the sole division for both film and television. That doesn't mean we won't get any Marvel TV shows. It's just they're all going to be produced in-house under the same umbrella that does the movies. Right now, Marvel Television has two live-action shows, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which will conclude in 2020. Shockingly, my God, it's still hanging on. And Hulu's Hellstrom, which will debut in 2020. A third show, Runaways, will end with its December 13th Season 3 release. Meanwhile, the animated side, Marvel has five shows in development for Hulu. These are Howard the Duck, Hit Monkey, Tigra and Dazzler, MODOK and the Offenders, and one for Disney Jr., which is Marvel's Spidey and his Amazing Friends. Loeb, of course, will remain with the company during the transition. However, he's on his way out. And as it turns out, the entire writing staff and production staff was fired from Tigra and Dazzler. So they were not happy with that show, apparently, Nick. So a lot of stuff in limbo here, it feels like.
It does feel that way. And I'll be honest, it makes a level of sense to me. Like, we've talked about before how Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. purported, you know, would tell you, hey, we're part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but we all knew it kind of really wasn't. Same thing with the Netflix shows, as great as they were at times. This way, with this approach, you would think that everything that comes out now, we will have an established idea of how it fits and where it fits, much like the way Star Wars is being run over at Lucasfilm at this point, you know, a clear direction in terms of continuity and where everything fits in story. So, I mean, it sucks for people to lose their job. It sucks for this division to be, you know, go away. But I'm kind of optimistic about the end result here.
True. Although I would throw out something I don't think is necessary that animated shows are in canon with movies.
No. And I'm not saying everything will be. I think the animated series, you know, those five that you mentioned, they haven't been canceled yet. I think animated shows will continue to do their own thing, but all the live action stuff should pretty much kind of be playing to the beat of the same drum.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to get canceled until they start tweeting. So they should be safe for now. That was a joke, people, before anyone gets mad at me. I'm just joking. Just joshing. Just pulling your chain. Sarsgaard. The dilapidated boat.
That's Sarsgaard.
Oh, I see.
Look at you.
I see. Oh, I'm sorry.
We've ever put respect on Sarsgaard's name.
Peter Sarsgaard has joined the cast of the Batman in an unnamed role. Of course.
His second turn at a DC Comics character.
That's right. Or is it, Nick?
Mm.
Do you think, Nick, this is the no. chance? Come on, hear me out. No. You're not even letting me finish.
Mm-mm.
Is this the nope. chance for Peter Sarsgaard to redeem the character of Hector Hammond before our very eyes?
No. No, it is not.
Why?
It's just not.
How do you know? Are you working on the film? You got inside sources on the set there?
I don't have any inside sources. I just know that film has become a running joke to the entire, not just the comic book industry, but kind of Hollywood in general. And I don't think there's any chance we go back and revisit it.
Well, maybe not that version of Hector Hammond, but the same actor playing the same character.
Now that would have been an awesome gag, Greg, if they could have had in Crisis where Pariah shows up on whatever Earth the Green Lantern movie allegedly took place in, and he watches it be destroyed. And he kind of just shrugs his shoulders and goes, "Eh," and then moves on.
Yeah, Tom Cavanaugh probably could have pulled that off really well, actually.
No big loss.
Yeah. On to the next one.
Hey, thanks, Anti-Monitor.
You know, the Anti-Monitor's, he's not all bad. He's pretty good.
He's pretty good.
Touchdown in Anti-Monitor? Nobody circles the wagons like the Monitor. All right. Let's move on to something much more serious.
Peter Sarsgaard, who do you think he's playing?
Well, I've already made it clear who I think he's playing. Who do you think he's playing?
No one knows. One of the rumors online right now is Harvey Dent, which, of course, I would be okay with. I think Sarsgaard's a good actor. And Harvey Dent, as people know, is my favorite villain in all of comics. Outside of that, if the Arkham Asylum rumors about this movie being heavily featured in Arkham are true, what about Hugo Strange?
I could see that. He's got the forehead. You know, but that's what I was gonna say. What if he plays Harvey Dent? I could be good with this, but when he becomes Two-Face, it elongates his head the way it did with Hector Hammond.
Greg.
It can happen. Now, if he doesn't play Hector Hammond, or version of Hector Hammond, and if he doesn't play Harvey Dent, what about, you talk about Arkham Asylum, what if he plays Jeremiah Arkham?
I could work.
I don't know why I made a seductive noise about that, but nonetheless, that's something for me to figure out. Let's move on to some trailers, shall we? Or one trailer in particular. And that is the first teaser trailer for Wonder Woman 84. Patty Jenkins and Gal Gadot return next summer in the long-awaited, really long-awaited sequel to Wonder Woman, taking place in 1984. Dropped this past week, lit the internet ablaze. Looks fantastic, Nick, in my humble opinion. I hate when people say humble, but I just did. My humble opinion, it looks tremendous. Chris Pine is back as Steve Trevor. We don't know how.
He's got a fanny pack?
Yes. We don't know why. But I, for one...
Because they're cool.
I, for one, am stoked. The setting looks great in the 80s. The soundtrack seems like it's going to be great. And Gal Gadot, as I talked to somebody at work about, she's the Christopher Reeve of her generation. She has embodied this character the same way that Chris Evans embodied Captain America and Christopher Reeve embodied Superman. She's just radiant in this role, glorious in this role. So, yeah, I'm stoked, man. I got to be honest, I need to revisit Wonder Woman, the movie, because it's been so long since I've seen it. But I'm stoked for this, man. It looks good.
Yeah, it does. Great, great. And it seems like the action in the trailer looks... I mean, the first one had good action, particularly the No Man's Land sequence, but that was really the only... I would say the only really great action sequence in the film. And this one, it kind of shows you various different bits that look like they're coming from different action sequences throughout the movie. Yeah. So that's one area that I think they can stand to improve on. And that looks really cool, especially the effect of Wonder Woman, like swinging from lightning bolts using her lasso. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the gold armor. That's something I don't know if there's a comic book callback there that I'm missing.
I think it's a Kingdom Come reference, if I'm not mistaken. Let me...
Okay.
Ignore the typing sounds you're hearing, people. I came prepared for this show and don't need to Google things during the middle of an episode. I'm kind of a loser, do you think I am? What kind of, to quote the song from the great... who was it? Neil McCoy. What kind of fool do you think I am? Remember that song, Nick?
I do indeed remember that song, yes.
Yeah, it looks like, so, like the Kingdom Come armor just with pants instead of the skirt. So.
Right. So yeah, I mean all in all it looks good. Ready for this movie to come out and see how it holds up.
Indeed. It sounds wonderful. And if it holds up well, we could very well get our first Wonder Woman spinoff movie. Because director Patty Jenkins has confirmed that she is in the realm of writing and producing a spinoff of Wonder Woman that is focused solely on the Amazons. This would be about Themyscira and focusing on the characters other than Diana that we met in the first Wonder Woman movie. Hippolyta, presumably Artemis, characters like that are iconic and important to the Wonder Woman mythos, and showing us what happens on Paradise Island and how these women have gotten by over the years, living there and building their own culture there. So, yeah, this sounds awesome to me, Nick. I'm actually way more into this than I am the idea of the Trench movie.
Yeah, for sure, because there's seemingly something to this. We've seen characters that we would hook onto for this. I mean, who's going to be the lead character of the Trench? Like, you know,
Trench,
I don't know.
Trench number four.
Yes. Trenchman arbitrarily turning knobs to make it look like he's doing something.
some territorial jobber in a hood.
Yes. But all things considered, yeah, I'm down for this. But so long as it brings back, you know, the Hippolyta and what was her name? Antiope.
Yeah.
And the other Amazons that we know from that opening bit of Wonder Woman.
Totally agreed. It sounds wonderful to me. Wonderful. Terrible. Terrible.
Wonderful.
They call him Mr. Wonderful. I am Mr. Wonderful. I am Mr. Wonderful. I am Mr. Wonderful. I am Mr. Wonderful. Had to get them all, Nick. Sorry. Well, apparently, I can't find the link here in front of me, but apparently there's also been a release date set for the Flash movie. And there it is right there. I found the link. The Flash movie from DC, Warner Brothers, has given a new release date of July 1, 2022. Still slated to star everyone's favorite Flash, Ezra Miller. I don't think this means anything, Nick, to you.
God, I hope not.
I hope not, too. We don't want Ezra Miller as the Flash. Fine young man,
we don't.
I'm sure. But, and a fine actor, I'm sure. But we don't want him as the Flash. Quite frankly, Nick, I'm to the point where if it's going to be Barry Allen, I just want Grant Gustin as the Flash. I'm going to be that fan. I'm going to be that guy.
You're just now to that point? I think you've been to that point for quite some time, as
I have. I have. I hate being that guy. Say, oh, well, you know, nobody else can play this character. You're always proven wrong in this circumstance. But in this case, I just...
It would be one thing if we felt like they weren't letting Grant Gustin do it because they had this wildly different interpretation of the character they wanted to put on the big screen. Right. But that's not... I don't believe that's the case. Because remember when the Flash movie looked like it was about to happen and the synopsis that came out, that it was like... It was like Barry Allen must learn how to use his speed powers while dealing with Harrison Wells at Star Labs, all the while trying to free his
father
accused father. And I was like, that's literally the
Flash. That's the Flash TV show. They're just going to try to – it reminds me of when what was the classic Dan Didio quote about 52, how Countdown was going to be 52 done right. Uh-huh. Sounds like Warner Brothers was like, okay, this is going to be that CW TV show done right. It's already been done right, first of all. Second of all – Grant Gustin, if you wanted to start a new movie universe around him, he can do it. He's a good enough actor to do it. You don't have to get some Hollywood guy that has bona fides somewhere else. You can get Grant Gustin for a lot cheaper probably, and he's going to be better as Barry Allen. He's Barry Allen, bottom line. So that's just my take on it. Others can feel free to disagree. Supergirl has recast the character of the legendary Superman baddie, Mr. Mixelpidelic. Did I get that right, Nick? I think so.
I think that's pretty good. Pretty
good. Listen, Cecil Hurt here, Mr. Mixelpidelic.
No one cares. Except for us.
We care. That's all that matters.
We care. No one else cares.
Reno 911 co-creator and actor Thomas Lennon has been cast to recur as Mr. Mixelpidelic for Supergirl Season 5. He's replacing Peter Gaggio, the oddly attractive Mixelpidelic from Season 2 of Supergirl. And what are your thoughts here, Nick? You know more about Reno 911 than I do.
I'm good with it. I like Thomas Lennon. He's kind of a good bit comedic player. And I think he comes off as a little bit creepier than that, as you said, oddly attractive version that we had in Season 2. So plus with the fallout from Crisis, something of a multidimensional imp and kind of Mixelpidelic's typical reality hopping kind of makes sense that he would be kind of miffed at many of his realities being destroyed.
Yes. I still don't understand why they didn't get Gilbert Gottfried. That's just me. He did a great job on the cartoon. We also, during Crisis Aftermath, tie it back to the point of the show, Crisis. During the Crisis Aftermath show hosted by Kevin Smith, we got to see the first trailer of the joint DC Universe and CW show. We'll see how that works out. Stargirl. What the hell? Stargirl. Trailer.
What?
My computer was doing something really weird just now, Nick. You can't see it on your side of the studio, but it was the cursor was moving all over the place for no reason.
Whatever it is that you and your computer do together in the privacy of your own home is none of my business, sir.
Sometimes we do it in the privacy of your home.
Well, nothing wrong with that. Lord knows me and my phone have done things in the privacy of your home. Numerous times.
Lord, I don't want to know that. But what I do want to know is Stargirl's future on the CW. So it's going to premiere on, as I understand it, it'll premiere on the app and then get shown on CW the next day, or is it vice versa?
Yeah, so it's on DC Universe one day before it airs on the CW.
And we got the first teaser trailer with Luke Wilson, which I guess I had just forgotten about. Luke Wilson playing the role of Pat Dugan, Hacksaw Pat Dugan, as I call him. And of course, the debut of our new Stargirl, the character of Courtney Whitmore. And Geoff Johns got to intro the trailer. This is a character very special to him based on his late sister, Courtney. And I was really impressed with this trailer. I thought it was tremendous. It looks, as you know, Nick, I have something of an affinity for the Courtney Whitmore character, Stargirl, even though I haven't read a lot of Justice Society comics. I've always just, every time that she's popped up in a book that I've been reading or a show that I've been watching, Justice Unlimited, for instance, I've always really loved her character and what she represents. And this show looks like it was just taken from the comic page. As far as Geoff wrote it, so I'm assuming it is going to be very much along the same lines as his first issue of Stars and Stripes from back in like 1998 or 99. I thought it looked great, man. I'm excited to see what they do with it. The budget looked really good for it, although I would assume that that might dip if they stay on the CW. But at least for the first episode, the budget looked tremendous from the trailer. And yeah, I'm stoked, man. I think it's going to be really good.
Yeah, it looks cool. We're going to get more of the Justice Society on here. We're going to get the Injustice Society on here. All kinds of cool stuff going on. So I'm down for it.
Yeah, this is our first mention of the Justice Society in some time in the Arrowverse. Right. Where we heard well, I say in the Arrowverse. We don't know if this is in the Arrowverse technically or if it's in the Titansverse. But I guess everything's in the Arrowverse now as of Crisis, so...
Yeah,
I'm stoked, man. It's gonna be good. What's her name? Breck Bassinger. What a great name. Mm-hmm. Is playing Courtney Whitmore / Stargirl. We also, of course, have Luke Wilson in here as Hacksaw Dum Dum Dugan. Lou Ferrigno Jr. is playing Rex Tyler / Hourman.
Mm-hmm.
Joel McHale
is playing the Sylvester Pemberton Starman.
Yeah, this is tremendous. What a lineup. Amy Smart is in the show as the mom. And yep. I think she was in the movie Walking Tall with The Rock, if I'm not mistaken.
Amy Smart, was she?
I thought I remembered that. I could be.
I know she was in Road Trip most notably at that time. She was in Varsity Blues.
No, she was not. She was in The Butterfly Effect. That's what I was thinking of with Ashton Kutcher.
Rat Race, if you remember that comedy.
I do remember Rat Race. National Lampoon's Barely Legal. I mean, I've never seen that. I don't know.
Ryan Reynolds in Just Friends. She's done a lot of stuff.
Just Friends is pretty good, actually, too.
Oh my god!
Come on, Just Friends.
No, absolutely not.
It's pretty funny.
Nope.
Isn't it? I don't remember. Is it not the movie I'm thinking? No, wait. I thought the movie I'm thinking about had Brittany Murphy in it. What was that movie? Had Friends in the title. Brittany Murphy. Remember her? Don't you guys love listening to this?
Just Friends was the movie where Ryan Reynolds was all fat when he was
high school. Yeah, he wore a fat suit. Fat suits are funny. Yeah. You need to accept it. Brittany Murphy died 10 years ago?
Yes, years ago.
What the hell?
Damn it, why wasn't I told?
This is ridiculous.
Oh,
this
God.
This is ridiculous. How did that happen?
How is anyone listening to
Just
this?
Married was the movie I was thinking of.
Oh, yeah, Just Married. That had Ashton Kutcher. That was bad, too.
Oh, come on. They had just gotten married.
That was the idea.
Stuff happened, you know?
And they got into all kinds of wacky hijinks on their honeymoon.
Yeah, damn right they did. Well, I think they didn't want to get married, but they got married anyway or something. And she was the voice of Lou Ann Platter on King of the Hill.
She was. That's true.
Damn it. I'm sad now. This is not good. This is not right.
She died like 8 years ago.
10 years ago, in fact. 2009.
I was about to say, I know it's been a while.
Oh, my gosh. This is a cosmic oddity, Nick, that we're even talking about this right now.
What?
I'll tell you why. Because do you know when she died? December 20th, 2009.
What does that have to do with
anything?
We're
in December of 2019. We're almost 10 years to the day that she passed. And we just happened to come across this conversation.
I guess. There
are forces at work on this show that people just don't understand, Nick, including you, apparently. Cosmic forces.
Also true.
In any event, that's the end of the rundown. We got nothing else. Anything else we forgot to talk about, Nick? I don't think so. I think that's everything.
No, yeah, I think that's pretty much it.
Well, you know, I'm looking over here at the hourglass as the sands fall through it. Speaking of sands through the hourglass, by the way, I just found out recently that one of the shows I used to enjoy watching when I was a youngling, and even later than a youngling, Days of Our Lives, they have actually resurrected the character of Stefano DiMera, even though the actor is long dead now. And they've taken a traditional heroic character and they've transplanted Stefano DiMera's consciousness into this hero character. And nobody knows that the hero is actually the evil villain Stefano DiMera.
You know how we talk about this show being the audience of two a lot of the time? Right now it's the audience of one.
I'm good with it. So anyway, let's talk about the great body transplant stories in comics history, Nick. No, let's do that for another time.
In soap opera history.
No, you know, soap operas, comics, wrestling, it all ties together. Oh, wrestling. That's what I was looking at the hourglass for in the first place. It's time. Wrestling Minute. Now, Nick, I understand you haven't watched any wrestling in about 5 years at this point.
That's not true. I watched Monday Night Raw this week.
And?
It sucked. Mostly. I mean, what else do you want from me?
Well, I'll tell you what I've been watching, huh? So, I watched the, why did I say it like that? That was weird. I watched, that was a weird thing. Anyway, what? I watched AEW last week, caught up on that over the weekend. Thought it was mostly quite good. Enjoyed it. Probably one of the lesser episodes they've had, honestly. But it still had good stuff on it. I believe Rey Fénix had a great match with Trent Beretta. And that was entertaining and enjoyable. I continue to enjoy any time Jericho talks, although I did not as much enjoy Luchasaurus talking. And I don't remember what else even happened. Yeah, there was a lot of good things that were going on throughout the course of the show. The Young Bucks and Dustin versus LAX and Sammy G.
No, not LAX.
Proud and powerful.
I don't know which one. I don't know which is
And Sammy G, that tag match was excellent. Excellent. Really good. High pace, high fast, high spots, high everything. It was great.
High evolutionary.
And so AEW delivered a strong product. I only saw the end of NXT, the main event, which was, again, excellent. Keith Lee is a monster among men. I don't mean Braun Strowman. He is fantastic. Came in, had a nice little showing, beating up Finn Balor.
I think we need to get Monty Brown. Find him and get Dolph Ziggler to come out. Dolph Ziggler. And he just stands there and takes pounces over and over again. And we have a pounce off. And I think the winner is determined by the total distance traveled on 5 cumulative pounces.
I love it. As I understand it, Nick, Adam Cole is still circling the Impact Zone. Not the Impact Zone. The NXT Zone.
The Impact Zone. Look at how little you think of the Full Sail crowd.
He's still circling the NXT Zone. Full Sail.
Full Sail.
After the result of the pounce that he received off camera, Nick. And so I'd love to see it. What is Monty Brown doing these days anyway? Why is he not on our TVs?
I think he didn't. He have like a legitimate family issue. Like he had to go raise his sister's kids.
Yeah, but that was 10 years ago or more.
Well, kids take a while to grow up. Right?
They can make it on their own once they're 12 or 13. They're fine.
Perhaps.
You'll find out. Once your kids hit 12 or 13, you'll be like, ah, you got it. Daddy, how do I?
You'll go on out in the world now.
How do I? Nope, you'll figure it out. It's best for you to just figure it out on your own.
Oh.
All right, that's going to be good. Well, in any event, I only saw a little bit of SmackDown, but not a good show from what I saw. Not a good show. I do like the Bray Wyatt and Miz feud. I think that's good, at least so far. I did think it was bait and switch though, because they advertised. I don't know if you'd agree with this, Nick, but they advertised what happened to Daniel Bryan, and they never actually showed Daniel Bryan during the course of the show. I don't like that.
Mm. Yeah, that is a bit frustrating for sure.
I want to see the new Daniel Bryan. And then other than that, there wasn't any wrestling. I did watch the Table for Three about TNA on the WWE Network, which is still somewhat surreal that they're talking about that on the WWE Network. But it was Sting, Jeff Jarrett, and AJ Styles. Enjoyed that. I was a longtime TNA fan, as Nick will attest. I was a TNA defender long past the point where they deserved having defenders. So there you have that. Well, that's about it. Oh, and the other big news, Nick, I'll let you tell the people about this. We are in the midst of our WrestleMania planning season.
Yep. We are picking out the events we're going to attend. We're trying to figure out our busy schedules for that week, and that is currently the plan. It'll be the first time ever we've done a full week in the city of the WrestleMania host city. So looking forward to it.
I understand also, Nick, that we're going to go have some crab legs with Jameis Winston. We're going to join the two or three people in the stands at a Tampa Bay Devil Rays game. We're going to we might even take in a little bit of the Tampa Bay Lightning. I don't think they'll be playing at that point. Well, they will be. Yeah. We're gonna make ourselves known around the town, all the big heavy hitters in the Tampa Bay area. Who knows? You might even run into the Hulkster, Nick.
Oh, wouldn't that be something? I am, of course, going to get to see Hulk Hogan be inducted into the Hall of Fame for a second time, which is just outstanding.
Whereas in my estimation, I am going to probably skip the Hall of Fame ceremony, which I understand, by the way, Nick, you better be careful because it will be a pit of danger. So you got to be careful about that. I instead will be taking my time to one of the independent shows, perhaps the WrestleCon Super Show or Josh Barnett's Bloodsport 3. Any number of options, or I might stay in our Airbnb and watch the movie Bloodsport, which is always a good choice.
There you go.
Well, sounds like it's about time for us to wind things down, Nick, for us to depart. And unfortunately, our good friend Jim Ross, I don't know if you've read on his Twitter, but he has a lot of travel issues. You ever notice that?
He does. He and Delta and Southwest and United, they have all kinds of issues with one another.
Yeah, and so as a result of that, he was not able to make it to Vancouver this week for the show. And we weren't able to get him on the phone. Signal was lost. So Mr. Ross, unfortunately, will have to miss this episode. We'll try to have him back next week if he can work out his travel issues. Yeah, it's a busy time, folks. We got to take it easy on these airline workers. They're busy. They're overworked. A lot of people traveling. But certainly we hope that they can get the good old JR here in the studio a week from now. In the meantime, enjoy The Crisis. If you haven't watched it yet, go back and rewatch it. Enjoy comic books, enjoy wrestling, enjoy life, guys. Just find what you love and enjoy it. We will catch you next time. Adios, amigos.
Our traveling fanboys.